I just want to go over basically the first two mitzvahs in the parsha, just to be sure we understand them. The first mitzvah is the mitzvah of bringing bikurim. Now, bringing bikurim is first fruits, but the word fruit is a little misleading, because the mitzvah of bikurim is lav dafka fruit, but it's a mitzvah of the shiva saminim, the seven species of Eretz Yisrael. And that includes chita, saora, wheat and barley, gefen, grapes, te'ena, figs, rimon, pomegranates, zeishemen, which is olives or olive oil, and davash, which is date honey, not bee honey. And you're mechuyev to bring, if you're a farmer in Eretz Yisrael, you're mechuyev to bring a portion of those crops to Yerushalayim. You bring them to the Beis HaMikdash, you wave them in front of the Mizbeach, and you put it down, and then the Kohen eats them. Now, Bikurim are not a Korban, because they're not eaten in the Beis HaMikdash. The Bikurim can be eaten actually anywhere. They don't even have to be eaten in Yerushalayim, but they have to be brought to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, what is the quantity of Bikurim, right? So the Mishnah says, we say it every day, Elo Adborim Shein Lahem Shior. Certain things do not have a quantity, and among them is Bikurim. Right? Bikurim has no shior. What else does not have a shior in terms of this? Truma doesn't have a shior. De oraisa, you could even give one chita achas. Midrabanan, they were mechayev by truma that could give either one between 1/60th and 1/40th. Ebenoni gives 1/50th, 2%. For bikurim, the chlal, there is no shior at all. But an important thing to know, there are two things to know about bikurim that are significant. Number one, unlike Truma and Maisa, which apply even today, the mitzvah of Bikurim terminates when there's no Beis HaMikdash. When there's no Beis HaMikdash, there is no mitzvah of Bikurim. That is why Bikurim are not practiced today at all. That's the first point. The second point is that Bikurim is unique in Truma and unlike Truma and Maisa, because with Truma and Maser, until you separate Truma and Maser, there's an issue of Tevel. In other words, I'm not allowed to eat any of my grain until I separate Truma and Maser. That's called the issue of Tevel. Bikurim does not produce an issue of Tevel. So even before I bring my Bikurim, I'm allowed to eat from my crops. There is no issue of Tevel. Even before I separate the Bikur. Right? So those are two points. It's only knowing Bisman HaMikdash. There is no Isser of Tevel. Now, the other thing that's unique about Bikurim is that when you bring it to the Beis HaMikdash, you have to recite something. Right? So this is, there are two separate mitzvahs. There's a mitzvah to bring Bikurim, and there's a mitzvah to be korei certain psukim. And in fact, if you learn the Mishnayos at the beginning of Maseches Bikurim, we discover that some people bring Bikurim and they have a mitzvah to read. And there are other circumstances where a person is chayef to bring Bikurim, but he does not recite a parsha. An example would be a ger. A ger who has land in Eretz Yisrael, now obviously he bought it or something, does bring Bikurim. But he does not recite the four-verse recitation, because the recitation says, Hashem swore to our forefathers, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, to give us the land. Now, that raises a very interesting controversy. Because the Mishnah seems to say that a ger does not read the Parsha of Bikurim, because a ger cannot refer to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov as his forefathers, because in point of fact, they are not his forefathers. Right? That's what the Mishnah seems to say. So the question that applies to us would be, okay, so how can a ger daven Shemona Esrei? At least with the Nusach that we have. Every Shemona Esrei, we start off, Elokeinu, God is our God. Ve'elokei avoseinu, he is the God of our forefathers. So l'chayra, what can a ger say? So according to one opinion in the Mishnah, Taka, a ger, consistent with the rule of Bikurim, a ger does have to deviate a little bit. And a ger has to say, Elokeinu, God is our God, Ve'elokei Yisrael, and is the God of the Jewish people, and he, or Elokei Avos Yisrael, and the God of the forefathers of the Jewish people. And in fact, he does not say, Elokei Avoseinu. Now, the question is, do we paskin this way? So here we have a very, very interesting letter that the Rambam wrote. The Rambam got a letter. Now, in addition to the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam wrote a number of letters, some of which were private, others were semi-public letters. And these are published. You know, we learn them and we look at them. They're very, very interesting. Some of them were written in Arabic and translated. Some of them were written in Hebrew. And one of the famous letters of the Rambam was a letter that was written to him by Ovadia Hager, a non-Jew converted to Judaism. And in those days, it was quite dangerous. Remember, these were, even today in the Middle East or even in America, if a Muslim converts to Judaism, they can be killed. And, it is actually very dangerous to this very day, maybe more so today, and certainly in the Rambam's time it was absolutely very, very dangerous. And yet, Ovadia the Ger did convert to Judaism, and he was told by the local rabbi, who was not so sensitive, that this Ger was not allowed to say Elokei Avoseinu, because since he was a Ger, he would have to say the God of the fathers of Israel. He could not call Avram his father. So the Rambam was, we always have the impression of the Rambam being calm and collected and not losing his cool. You could see the anger of the Rambam coming forth from this letter. You could really see it. Makes you shiver. Gee, I wouldn't want to be at the receiving end of that letter. He says this person is a Rasha and this person is an Am Haaretz, and he transgresses the many, many times in the Torah where the Torah says you have to treat a ger with sensitivity 30 times, over 30 times. He says, Chas v'shalom, how could he tell you this? When we say we're a child of Abraham, we are not referring to genealogy. We are referring to belief in Hashem. Abraham taught the world that there's one God, and when you follow a belief in one God who gave the Torah, you are a child of Abraham. And indeed, what do we write? A ger is called Ben Abraham. That's exactly what he is called. We have shilas, different shilas, sometimes not to embarrass a ger. You could call him up by a different name, whatever it will be. But technically, every ger is a Ben Abraham. So the Rambam basically says, we don't paskin like that Mishnah in Bikurim. That Mishnah in Bikurim seems to be taking the position that if you're not physically descended from Abraham, you cannot call him your forefather. We paskin the other way around, that being a child of Abraham, and I guess by extension, Yitzhak and Yaakov. I mean, the truth is, the Rambam doesn't prove his point 100%, because in Shemona Esrei, you're not just saying, Abraham is my father, you're also saying Yitzhak and Yaakov. Now, even if you construct the argument that because Abraham taught the world belief in one God, every person who follows Abraham's ways is a child of Abraham, that doesn't mean he's a child of Yitzhak and Yaakov. Okay, but the Rambam considers all three of us as teachers of godliness in the world, so everyone who follows those ways becomes a child of the Avos. So the Rambam says, Beferish, we do not paskin like that Mishnah in Bikurim and like
just going back regarding the ger owning Abraham, and property.
Yes, there's no Avera at all for a ger to own property in Eretz Yisrael. There's an Avera in the Torah to sell land to a non-Jew in the land of Israel. But a ger is a Jew. Now, the only problem with the ger is this, and that is, there's no way when you have the institution of Yovel that a ger could ever be a permanent owner of property. Because what's going to happen is this. Since a ger can only acquire by buying property, a ger could not acquire property by inheriting it from a Jew. So like anyone else who buys property, when the Jubilee year comes, the property will go back to the original owner. So a ger cannot own property in perpetuity. A ger can only own property until the Yovel year, after which it would go back. But apparently the Mishnah maintains that even that type of semi-permanent ownership would be enough to bring Bikurim. And that would be, that's really another issue, actually. And that's Lavdavka Ger. That would apply to anybody. If I buy a field, do I have to take Bikurim from the field? That's more of a general question. Do I have to be absolutely the owner, or is temporary ownership considered to be enough? But if we assume temporary ownership is enough, then a ger would bring Bikurim, and the only question would be, he would be excluded from the recitation, but according to the Rambam, we would actually say he would read it as well. Okay. So this is called the Mitzvah of Kriya. Now, the Mitzvah of Kriya is a very short recitation, and in fact, it should be very, very familiar to you if you remember your Pesach Seder, because Chazal lifted, this is a short history of the Jewish people, from the time of the Avos to Yetzias Mitzrayim. So it's a four-verse history of Am Yisrael, expressing gratitude to Hashem. And Chazal lifted these psukim, and they made them the foundation of the Haggadah Shel Pesach. Okay, this is the part of the Haggadah that people often fall asleep for, because it's, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we talk about this. The parts of the Haggadah that people like the most are actually the least important parts of the Haggadah. For example, something like the four sons. You know, the four sons, which everyone, you know, people will spend hours about the four sons. You know, the four sons is an introduction to the mitzvah of Haggadah by simply describing that you have to narrate to different types of people. Aram Yoviravi is the Haggadah itself. So it's interesting that people are fascinated with the introductory passages of things, but not to the actual story itself. Now, the way Chazal did it was, this is the way the Haggadah works, is they take these four verses, they subdivide it by individual phrases, and then they explain the verses by reference to other verses. Now, Bukhari, you might ask a question, well, why explain Psukim by bringing in other verses? Just give us the whole story. I mean, if you wanted to know, where does the Torah give you the story of the Exodus? The answer is, the first 12 chapters of the book of Shmos is the story of the Exodus. So why did Chazal take Arami Obed Avi as the story in which it then elaborates by bringing in certain verses from Exodus, just give you the story from Shmos? So there are two answers for this. Answer number one is that to make a Haggadah that would require 12 Prakim of Chumash would be too much. That would be a big story. So essentially, we're looking for a real newspaper-like summary. So Aram Yovid Avi is a great summary. It's a four-verse summary, so I don't have to mention everything in Shmos. And if we need to flesh it out a little bit, we bring in, at appropriate points, verses from Shmos to explain things that are a bit obscure. So one reason is a very simple reason. We simply want to have an outline. There's another reason, though, a very deeper reason, a very, very fascinating idea, and that is the idea that it's been pointed out many times that in the Haggadah Shel Pesach, Moshe Rabbeinu's name is not mentioned. Actually, it is mentioned once in the middle of something, but Derech Klal, Moshe Rabbeinu is extremely de-emphasized. How could that be? So the reason that's given is that since on the night of Yetzias Mitzrayim, we want to emphasize that Hashem is our Redeemer. And that's why we say Hashem and no angel, Hashem and no Soros, etc. And we don't want people to look at Moshe as somehow having all of this power to redeem us. The Haggadah deliberately de-emphasizes the role of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, here's the question. If you want to create a sefer of Yetzias Mitzrayim that de-emphasizes the role of Moshe Rabbeinu, using the book of Shmos as your primary source would make that literally impossible. Because there is not a single verse in Shmos that does not mention Moshe Rabbeinu's name. Moshe's name is not mentioned, but in the Exodus chapters. I won't say it's not a single passage, but there are some psukim, but basically you could not tell the story without bumping into Moshe a million times. So it would be like a minefield. So Chazal are mechapes a summary that does not mention Moshe Rabbeinu's name, and that happens to be these four verses. Right? So that's another reason why Chazal were koveya. Now, some say as well that perhaps there's a little bit of a remez. The Torah itself is merames. I think the Arsameach says the Torah is merames that Arami Oved Avi should be the aside of Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim by kind of a Gezeirah Shavah. Gezeirah Shavah is when the Torah uses the same word in two places, indicating that the context should be connected. And that is the mitzvah of declaring the Exodus is based on the verse "V'higada tel levincha," you shall tell your child on that day that because of all that Hashem did for me, I am thanking you. So what's the verb that is used? V'higadata. That is why the narrative is called Haggadah. V'higadata levincha. How does Arami Yoved Avi begin? Higadati hayom l'Hashem Elokecha. I am declaring to God today that I have come to Eretz Yisrael. The word Haggadah is exactly the same. The word Haggadah is used in both phrases, and therefore Chazal could see this as a basis for including this parsha in Yetzias Mitzrayim, in the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. Okay. Now let's look at the actual words here. The first reason was that we need something short. If you took the psukim from Shemos, you'd have 12 prakim. So he wants something that would only be a few verses. This is a very excellent summary. The second reason is you're looking for something that does not mention Moshe Rabbeinu. And the third reason is the remez of the Higadata. Now, let's look at the actual psukim themselves, because the beginning is very familiar to us from Haggadah, but it's a problematical pasuk. The Onisa of the Amarta, you who brought your Bikurim to Hashem, you shall declare in front of Hashem, in other words, in the Beit HaMikdash, Arami Oved Avi Vayered Mitzrayma Vayogar Sham Bimseimat Vayisham Lagoy Gadol Atzum Barav. Okay, let's take the first three words. Arami Oved Avi. What is the translation of Arami Oved Avi? So Rashi says the following, and this is a big machlokas. Rashi follows Chazal, actually, so it's really Chazal, and this is what the Haggadah says as well. I'll share with you the Ibn Ezra, who gives a radically different translation of the words. Arami means the Syrian, from Aram. The Syrian, Oved. Now Oved, we know as Avedah, is to lose, but it also means to destroy. Arami Oved Avi. The Syrian tried to destroy my father. And therefore my father went down to Mitzrayim instead. He left Syria and went to Mitzrayim. So who is the Syrian who tried to destroy my father? So Rashi says, as you know from the Haggadah, the Syrian is a euphemism or a nickname for Lavan. Lavan is called Lavan Harami, and the pasuk says Lavan tried. Although the word is interesting, you know, the word "tried," by the way, is being supplied in translation because Oved does not mean tried to destroy. Oved means destroyed. But again, Rashi says since Baruch Hashem Yaakov was not destroyed, so behechrich we have to translate the word Oved not to mean he actually destroyed him, but we have to put it in brackets. You have to put in tried to destroy my father. Yeah.
But what about Shad? Like, what aspect did he actually destroy?
Okay, so that's the question. So the question is, what do we mean, Lavan? I'm going to ask two questions. One is your question. What do we mean, Lavan? Assuming Lavan is our Arami, okay, let's accept that. Lavan tried to destroy my father. Where do you see that Lavan tried to destroy Yaakov? Lavan cheated Yaakov, to be sure. Right? Lavan wanted to keep Yaakov there, etc. But where do you see that Lavan wanted to destroy Yaakov? That's question number one. Question number two is, there seems to be a non sequitur in the pasuk. Lavan wanted to destroy my father, and therefore my father went down to Egypt. Well, that's not what happened. Yaakov did not, like, run away from Lavan's house and go to Egypt. What happened was, Yaakov returned to Eretz Yisrael, and Yaakov stayed for a number of years. Yosef was sold into slavery, and 22 years after that, Yaakov comes down to Mitzrayim. What is the causal connection between whatever Lavan did and Yaakov going down to Mitzrayim? Yaakov did not seem to go to Mitzrayim in response to anything that Lavan did, right? That's the second question. So here, let me answer the first question separately, because the Chidah gives a very, very fascinating teretz to the first question, but it doesn't answer the second question at all. So we'll have to have a different teretz for that. The Chidah wants to say that the way Lavan tried to destroy Yaakov is not referring to anything that Lavan did to Yaakov. It goes all the way back when Eliezer, Abraham's servant, came to find a wife for Yitzchak. Because what happened? If you remember, at that time, Lavan, of course, is Rivka's brother. When Eliezer came, Besuel was still alive. But if you recall, although Besuel starts off being the one that's speaking on behalf of Rivka, eventually Lavan takes over, and Chazal have an interpretation that Lavan wanted to poison Eliezer to take all of the wealth, but the poison got switched and Besuel died. Right? You heard that medrash. Now, yeah, there actually is a medrash that Lavan poisoned his own father accidentally because he wanted to poison Eliezer. Now, well, still, how would that destroy Yaakov? Because here's the thing. A very fascinating halacha. The Gemara in Nazir tells us the following thing. Let's say I make a sholiach to marry a woman for me. And I don't tell them which woman to marry. I say, hey, I trust you. Go marry somebody. Whoever you marry on my behalf is good enough for me. Okay? The shaliach dies. And he didn't report to me which woman he married on my behalf. So the Gemara says the following idea. The Gemara says, I'm not allowed to marry anybody in the world. I'm not allowed to marry anybody in the world. And the reason is, even though, well, why not? I mean, if she's not my wife, if polygamy is okay. The answer is no. Because since I don't know who I'm marrying, so maybe any other woman might be my wife's sister. It might be my wife's daughter. In other words, if you're married to A, there are certain relatives of A that you're not allowed to marry. So since you don't know who the A is, any given woman might be a prohibited relative. Now, Lamaisa, this is hardly ironclad, because you could certainly identify a woman who does not have any relative that you could be married to that would make her other. Okay, but the Gemara says as a general principle, there is such a chashash. Now, Menela like this, if Eliezer would have died, and he wouldn't have reported to Avram, because Avram didn't say marry a specific woman, right? Avram says go to my place. Then Yitzchak would never have been able to be married. If Yitzchak would never have been able to be married, then there never would have been a Yaakov. So Lavan would have destroyed Yaakov by Yitzchak's inability to marry. Again, that's the Chidah. It's a famous pshat of the Chidah. It actually is very, very difficult. I'll tell you why. Because even though Avram didn't tell Eliezer which specific woman to marry, Avram did tell Eliezer to take a woman from his makom. So, consequently, if he didn't know which woman from that makom, then theoretically Yitzchak could have married a woman from any other makom who didn't have a relative in that makom. In other words, there would have been somebody Yitzchak could have married. This is what the Chidah says. But even with the Chidah's interpretation, that doesn't explain what is the connection between what Lavan wanted to do and Yaakov going to Mitzrayim. So because of this, we have a thought from the Chassam Sofer, which answers both questions in a very good way. If you remember, in the covenant of the parts, the Bris Bein Absarim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avraham, your children are going to be enslaved in a land that is not theirs for 400 years, and then I will judge that nation and then take them out. Now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not say that that had to be Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is not mentioned in that pasuk. Theoretically, the gezeira of galus, slavery, inoy, persecution, could have been mekoyim anywhere. So l'chaira, just as a matter of convenience, if Yaakov is already in Lavan's house, why don't we just continue Yaakov there and that'll become the servitude and everything else? The answer is no. The answer is that had Yaakov remained in Laban's house, he would have been destroyed, because there are two types of enemies that the Jewish people face. One type of enemy tries to destroy us in a physical way, like Haman. They destroy the body. They hate us. They're our enemies. But there's another type of enemy that's much more difficult. That's the enemy that comes in the guise of a friend, in the guise of a brother, in which there is assimilation, there is intermarriage, there is a dilution of moral standards because you follow the ways. In fact, the guy who comes in the guise of friendship might be much more dangerous than the guy that comes in the guise of an enemy. Well, Baba Trevi used to say, and he had lived in both places, it's easier to be from in Siberia than suburbia. In Siberia, you knew you were Jewish. You didn't have any choice. When you know you're Jewish because the Umos Olam reject you, so you turn inward to Hashem and the Torah. But when the non-Jewish culture says, you're my brother, you're my friend, we're equal, that destroys you. So Memela, this is what the Pasuk is saying. Had Yaakov's family stayed in Laban's house, they would have been spiritually destroyed. Therefore, the galus had to be mekuyam, the galus had to be fulfilled in a place like Mitzrayim, which hated us and abused us physically. Because that, now although even there we were in the 49th level of Tumah, I mean, we were pretty close to being assimilated there too, but at least because of that persecution, we couldn't go all the way. And that's the connection. So, in a chinami, between Arami Oved Avi and Yerid Mitzrayim are many, many years. But the Torah is explaining that the Golos of Lavan would have been much worse than the Golos of Mitzrayim, and therefore Hashem had to fulfill Avram's decree, or the decree given to Avram, not in Lavan's house, but in Mitzrayim. Now, one other point, you have to stop in a minute. Everything we've said today is following Rashi's interpretation, that Arami Oved Avi means the Syrian, Lavan, try to destroy my father, Yaakov. So according to that, if you know your grammar, Arami is the subject, Oved is the verb or the predicate, and Avi is the object of the verb. The Syrian tried to destroy my father. Subject, verb, predicate. The Ibn Ezra learns entirely differently. He learns Arami Oved does not mean a Syrian tried to destroy. Rather, it's a noun and an adjective. A wandering Aramean was my father, meaning Arami Oved is a description of Yaakov. Yaakov! Now, why is Yaakov called a Syrian? Because Yaakov originally, you know, it's Avram. Avram originally comes from Aram. So essentially what we're saying is, we're thanking Hashem that even though my forefathers, in fact, Avi in this sense is not even Yaakov. Avi is referring to Avram. My father Avram wandered from Aram. And then Hashem sent him, but him does not mean Avram, his children. Hashem sent him to Mitzrayim and then gave us Eretz Yisrael. So according to this, the word Oved is a little more connected to being lost, because Oved is to wander. When something is, like when a sheep is wandering, it's lost, right? Or I've lost my sheep. So according to the Ibn Ezra, the translation is, Arami Oved Avi, my father was a wandering person from Aram, who was sent to Mitzrayim, and Hashem eventually took us out with miracles. And I am bringing Bikurim as gratitude for the miracles of Yitzias Mitzrayim and the bracha of getting Eretz Yisrael.
So, the thing in the letter is a disconnect between Arami and Oved Avi. Yeah, that problem is.
No, according to Devin Ezra, the pasuk actually is fairly clear, meaning to say that my original history was, that's what we're saying, that my father, my ancestor Abraham, wandered from place to place, and the final wandering of our nation was in Mitzrayim. And then the pasuk says, well, then it goes on, v'yogashem, well, again, what's doing in that case is that it's then referring to all of the descendants of my forefathers as one unit. So it's not referring to what he himself did. I think that would be difficult. The reason is, even though that part of the pasuk would fit, because Avram did go to Mitzrayim, but then it says, and the Egyptians did bad to us. So you'd have to say that's not referring to that. Because eventually, we're certainly referring to the Jews who were slaves in Mitzrayim. So you might want to say, perhaps, well, Yogashem is going on the first time, and then it switches to Osanu. The Yareo Osanu is that even though Avram, maybe it's so, even though Avram did many good things for them, but when we were in Mitzrayim, they did bad things to us. Yeah, that would be a possibility, according to the Ibn Ezra. But as I say, clearly in the Haggadah Shel Pesach follows Rashi, because the Haggadah Shel Pesach brings in Aram Yavid Avi when it tries to distinguish how Lavan is even worse than Pyro, because Pyro only wanted to kill the males, and Lavan wanted to destroy everybody. Shenemar Arami Obed Avi. And again, like the Chassam Sofer, that's the meaning in the Haggadah as well. Not that Lavan wanted to physically destroy us, but Lavan wanted to destroy us spiritually, and that would have affected the men and the women. Okay?